There have been a number of deadly clashes this year between the Turkish government and Kurdish rebels, surpassing last year's attacks in scope and violence. It comes at a time when Turkey is realigning itself on the global stage with a revised policy toward Israel and the West and closer ties to Iran. We're joined now by Elisa Marcus, who's written about the situation for Foreign Policy magazine. She's also the author of a book called Blood and Belief, the PKK and the Kurdish Fight for Independence, which is published by New York University Press. I'm very pleased to welcome her back to our show for today's second underreported segment. Hi, Elisa.
Hi.
Most of the news we've heard about Kurds in recent years is in relation to Iraq. Are there more Kurds in Iraq or in Turkey?
There are actually more Kurds in Turkey, and they feel very much underreported, let's say, because of all the attention lately towards the Kurds of Iraq.
There's also a sizable number in Iran, isn't there?
Quite a few in Iran, and there's some in Syria. And basically what they used to all have in common was that their cultural and linguistic rights, national rights, were completely ignored. Now, of course, the Iraqi Kurds are doing much better. They have their own federated state, which in a way has pushed the Kurds of Iran, Syria, and especially Turkey to demand greater rights as well.
Well, in the past, they all were talking about creating a new nation called Kurdistan, but that doesn't seem likely, does it?
No, not at all. And I think reality settled in for all of them, and they realized that the best they could hope for was really a federated state. But certainly in their hearts and in their a lot of their statements, they still refer to a greater Kurdistan.
Well, and the Kurds in Iraq seem to actually be in a better situation than most people in Iraq. What about Kurds in Turkey? Do they enjoy cultural and personal freedoms similar to what's happening to the rest of Turkey's population?
No, the situation for Kurds in Turkey is somewhat dire right now. They do have some limited rights. The state founded, for example, a 24-hour Kurdish language television station in 2009. But as Kurds will point out, that's something controlled by the state. They still aren't allowed to produce freely their own television station. They do have more Kurdish language books, which is different from 10 years ago when these things were routinely banned. But at the same time, writers who write about Kurdish nationalism will be arrested. People who use Kurdish in political meetings are arrested. A mayor I know in southeast Turkey who published a children's book in Kurdish, he was charged for that.
And is that all to discourage Kurdish demands for a Kurdish state?
Turkey is basically afraid that once it starts to allow Kurds to recognize their ethnic identity fully, they will want more, that they will want some sort of state. But the fact is that's happening already, even without having been granted linguistic and cultural rights. Kurds want more. They want some sort of control over their territory in Turkey.
Well, the Kurds in Iraq, of course, have oil fields, which gives them a bit more clout. Is there anything that the Kurds in Turkey can use for political clout?
No, they really don't have any minerals to speak of, or they may, but they haven't been discovered yet. The only thing the Kurds have, which they're using for political clout, is a guerrilla force. And that's, of course, very problematic because Turkey sees that as terrorism and then says that the demands must be demands of terrorists because it's the so-called terrorists who are promoting these demands.
And the PKK is classified as a terrorist group by the United States and the EU as well, isn't it?
It certainly is, and there's no question that the PKK is not necessarily a very nice organization. And most recently, for example, it set off a bomb in Istanbul. It killed six soldiers. It also killed a 17-year-old girl. It threatens its own people. It kills rebels who want to try to leave the organization. But at the same time, it's incredibly popular, and Kurds really have a great allegiance to this organization.
What about the other approach, the political approach? Is there a Kurdish political representation in Ankara?
There is political representation in Ankara. The Kurdish political party has 20 parliamentarians, and they also control almost 100 municipalities in the Kurdish region. The problem is that Turkey doesn't really recognize this. While the party is legal and it runs in elections, at the same time, its members are harassed frequently by the police. About 150 party members were recently charged for allegedly working with the PKK. The political party itself was shut down in December by the Constitutional Court. It reopened, but in the process, two of the parliamentarians were stripped of their right to practice politics for 5 years, and they were forced to leave parliament. So Turkey allows it, but at the same time, it's very uncomfortable with legal Kurdish politics, and it's constantly putting legal blocks in the group's way.
Is the PKK the Turkish equivalent of the IRA, do you think, in Northern Ireland?
I suppose in a way you could say that, yes. Although simultaneously I wouldn't say that the legal Kurdish party is similar to Sinn Féin. I mean, the legal Kurdish party is very much a separate entity from the PKK. Mm-hmm. That's not to say the rebels don't try to control the party or influence the party or put their people in the party, but it's not one and the same the way you had with Sinn Féin and the IRA.
When did the PKK start fighting with the Turkish military?
The PKK started fighting in 1984, back at a time when Kurds weren't even referred to as Kurds. And over the years, the PKK did very well. It built a lot of popularity, mainly because it was seen as the one group that was promoting Kurdish causes. Remember, this was at a time when Kurdish itself was actually banned. So Kurds really felt that they had no democratic outlet. At the end of 1999, the leader of the PKK was captured. He'd been in Syria, and Syria kicked him out, and he was finally found in Africa. And that sort of put a damper on the PKK's fight. For a couple of years, the PKK suspended its war. Its leader, Abdullah Öcalan, was in prison. He's still in prison on an island in off the Turkish coast called Imrala Island. But in 2004, partly because of the gains made by the Iraqi Kurds, the PKK decided to start fighting again. And since then, it's just gotten better at what it's doing.
Well, there's violence for a while, and then pauses. Have their goals changed over the years?
Their goals have definitely changed. They were the big proponents of a greater Kurdistan. But over time, even in the 90s, they were talking more about autonomy or self-rule. Right now, I would say what they're really looking for is a type of autonomy. They haven't fully defined it, and I think they'd be open to negotiations with the Turkish state, but it's clear they want to govern themselves in some way.
In a similar way to what's happened in Iraq?
I think the Iraqi model is a very positive model for the Turkish Kurds. They would welcome something like that, but they realize they may not get that close. For one, they don't have the oil resources. It doesn't give them any internal domestic clout.
My guest is Aliza Marcus, who's written a book called Blood and Belief, the PKK and the Kurdish Fight for Independence. She's talking with us about the recent increased, renewed violence between Turkey and the Kurds as part of our underreported series. And this year has been particularly deadly. How many people have been killed so far in the fighting?
More than 80, probably reaching close to 100. And that's really just Turkish soldiers, not including the number of rebels who have been killed. And the PKK has shown a very deadly reach. It's hit in Istanbul. It's hit further south near the Syrian border. It's hit along the Iraqi border. It's showing a very dangerous ability to get around Turkey and attack Turkish targets with ease.
And have they been targeting mostly military targets, or are they also going after civilians?
Generally, they try to focus on military targets, but of course their definition of military targets sometimes veers into what we would call civilian targets. So they've attacked teachers, doctors, state representatives, people who don't carry weapons, but they see them as representatives of the state, and therefore they consider them legitimate targets. But they don't really go strictly after civilians, although they have, in their urban attacks, they have at times targeted tourist areas. Now, that's something they suspended a few years ago because, obviously, it's something that brings them a lot of criticism, and as they try to make inroads into the Turkish left or make alliances with Turkish liberals, they need to be a little more sensitive to that sort of criticism. But what I think is going to happen or is happening now is that they're beginning to look again towards targeting Western Turkey. One of their arguments is, why should only our people suffer? Why should our attacks only happen in Southeast Turkey, where any retaliation can hit Kurds as well, any Turkish state retaliation. Let's bring our fight to the West. This is a very dangerous development and something, though, that they seem to be intent on.
Where are the PKK rebels based? Are they staying in Turkey, or are they going across the border to Iraq?
PKK rebels are primarily based in northern Iraq. That's where they have the bulk of their forces, which is about 5,000 fighters. However, they do keep a few thousand or a few hundred, depending on what's going on at the time, inside Turkey, sort of in mobile bases. They're constantly moving. They don't have any permanent structures inside Turkey the way they do have in northern Iraq.
So is it easy to slip across the border?
For you and I, it might not be so easy, but for practice PKK rebels, it is. There are mountain paths that they know. There are smugglers who can help them. They can pay off guards at the border. They seem to have little problem going back and forth.
The defense minister of Turkey announced on Wednesday that the country was forming a special military unit to fight the PKK. Why did they need a special unit?
A lot of their conscripts come in not so well trained. The terrain is very, very harsh along the border. The PKK rebels are quite practiced. They've been doing this type of guerrilla warfare now for close to 30 years, and they know the terrain well. You bring an 18, 19-year-old soldier who grew up in Istanbul, who's maybe never hiked up a mountain, and you stick him in some remote outpost, it's difficult for him to understand how to react. But the thing to remember is Turkey has promised a professional force for a long time now. And I think one of the Turkish government's problems is that they promise a lot, they threaten a lot, and they do neither.
Doesn't the Turkish government also have a large pro-government militia stationed on the Iraq border that's made up mostly of local Kurds? Should we assume that the Kurds in southeastern Turkey are divided about support for the Turkish government and the PKK?
Turkish government has always paid about 60,000 so-called village guards to help them defend their outposts and to track down Turkish Kurds. But they're not based along the border. They live in their villages, and as needed, they're called to take part. I would say there are some divisions. This is an obvious division. There are also Kurds who simply don't like the PKK. They believe the PKK should disarm. But the divisions are sort of divided between you have a smaller amount of number of Kurds who don't like the PKK and then a majority, let's say, who do.
Now, the Kurds are Muslims. In fact, Saladin, the greatest hero in Islamic history, was a Kurd, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
So what's the problem here?
The problem is that this isn't a religious issue. This is really an issue of ethnic nationalism. When Turkey was founded, the Kurds were essentially written out of Turkey's history. And for decades, their language was banned. There were attempts to forcibly assimilate them. When they did show any sort of interest in their ethnic national identity, they were arrested and charged. And now I think what we see is all over the world, ethnic minorities are interested in some sort of recognition. They're interested in some sort of self-rule. And the Kurds are part of this movement.
Well, in Turkey, of course, after World War I, the country became secular, and the military pretty much took control of the country. Now we have a government run by an Islamist prime minister, Erdogan. Hasn't he been trying to deal with the PKK politically? Is it because because he is less secular and because he's not a part of the military?
Well, that's what everybody thought when last year he announced plans for a democratic initiative that he said would help democratize Turkey and in the process give the Kurds more rights and thereby end the PKK's fight. But over the past 14 months, Erdogan has seriously wavered from that path. And right now, despite his origins from a more Islamist background, his view that, you know, all Muslims can work out their problems, he's basically reverted to business as usual, which is treat the Kurdish problem as if it's a problem of economics. You know, bring more investment to the region, and at the same time, just try to wipe out the PKK.
Rounding up Kurdish politicians, haven't they?
They've rounded up quite a few, including 8 sitting mayors.
Because they have been associated with the PKK, or is this a different aspect of internal politics in Turkey?
This is part of the Turkish state's fight against Kurdish nationalism and therefore against the PKK. The Turkish state generally views any Kurdish activism as helping the PKK. So this can be something as simple as publishing a children's book in Kurdish. It can be speaking out about human rights, or it can actually be transferring money to the PKK. One doesn't know. So the indictment against the 151 politicians that was recently handed down says that they're charged with helping the PKK. We don't really know whether that means actually helping the PKK or just doing sort of the normal democratic things that would be allowed in any other country.
Now, there's been a lot of tension recently between the government and the military. There was a crackdown on a number of high-ranking military officers accused of plotting a coup against the government. Are they both in agreement that they're against the PKK?
Right now, it looks like the one thing they do agree on is that they're both against the PKK. Yes, exactly. It's brought them together after about a year and a half of very serious tension. And I think, on the one hand, this could be Erdogan attempting to sort of placate the military by saying, well, I'm going after the bad seeds inside the military, but, you know, on basic national security issues, we see eye to eye. Or it could be because Erdogan, like many prime ministers before him, in the end, feels that, you know, he became a Turkish nationalist as well now. Despite his promises that he would do something on the Kurdish reality, he's backtracked, and he sees it again as simply a military problem.
In your piece for Foreign Policy magazine on negotiations, you write, making peace will require both sides, Kurdish and Turkish, to adopt some useful fictions. What are those useful fictions?
Well, I think that the Turkish state is going to have to act as if it's not negotiating with the PKK, even if it picks, let's say, independent Kurds or opens up talks with the legal Kurdish party. Because the fact is the PKK is very influential in the legal Kurdish party. And the supporters of the party are mainly supporters of the PKK. So it means that party officials have to be very sensitive or receptive to the demands and desires of the PKK. But at the same time, the PKK is going to have to step aside. It's going to realize that it can't overwhelm the negotiations, that it can't be out front, that at some point it has to let go and let politicians who are more expert in negotiating than rebel fighters actually do the negotiations. So I think the two sides are both going to have to step back a little bit and allow for a slightly opaque view. But it's really only through negotiations that this is going to be solved.
At a time when Turkey is changing its policies in the Middle East questioning whether it wants to be part of the EU, so I don't know whether those are connected to its approach to the Kurdish issue, but that's something we'll address sometime in the future, I hope. Lisa Marcus is the author of the book Blood and Belief, The PKK and the Kurdish Fight for Independence. Thank you so much for talking with us today on Underreported.